Hi, this is Andrew Poole with LaCourse Poole & Enval. Thanks for tuning into the Trainwreck Court podcast. Each week, we will post a new episode hosted by me, attorney Andrew Poole. Stay tuned for compelling local and national court cases each week. LaCourse Poole & Enval, experienced legal professionals helping our Northland neighbors for over 35 years. Our success is no accident. Find us online at northlandlawyers.com.
And welcome back, everybody. We are back in for another session of Trainwreck Court along with attorney Andrew Poole, Tom Robick, and myself, Kevin Key. And we're going to be revisiting at least a couple of the things we've talked about in the past here, or at least recently, right?
We have some updates. It's maybe been a little bit since we've come together for a podcast here, but some stuff has changed. I have some additional information, and I don't know, I can just jump right into it. We spoke two podcasts ago. Maybe it was the last one, actually. I'm sorry. Maureen Abalone, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing her name.
You know, I think that's right.
Abalone.
I think that you've got it right.
I think
Abalone,
I got it right.
Yeah, right. She is the inmate that is...
She's incarcerated in Shakopee.
Twin Cities,
she's a lifetime sentence.
Yeah.
Right?
And is now
life term.
Going to be an attorney or trying to become
and
one.
She's, yeah, and she's now enrolled at Mitchell Hamlin through a remote online program. Mm.
Well, she was accepted. That was kind of the big
accepted,
part of the story. Yeah.
And we'll get a Juris Doctor at the end of it if she sticks with it. And so after that podcast, we, had people listening to it. One specifically is a friend of hers who had some additional information to share with us. And I said, thank you very much. And I'm happy to, update our podcast because it's obviously we want the best information, most useful information. Mm-hmm. One of the things we had talked about, we had contemplated, we didn't know anything about her background, right? All I knew and all we knew what was in, the public record already and what people had written about, knowing that she was serving a life term for this, I guess, aiding and abetting a murder in the first degree, that it's not the circumstance where she actually killed anyone. She didn't.
Right.
I think everybody accepts that as fact. But she did graduate high school, is described as just a brilliant thinker, and she's a diligent student and came.
Now,
go on.
Are you aware, did she graduate high school while she was incarcerated or was before she went in? Do you have any idea?
I don't know, but get the sense it's before.
Okay.
Comes from a successful family. One of her sisters, she has siblings. One's a doctor.
Wow.
The other has an MBA in business and fashion design. She herself has two bachelor degrees, and she had those before entering prison.
What?
Yeah. And I think at least it seems was maybe studying for the LSAT already or had some designs or plans to go to law school prior to everything that happened to her, right?
But still got mixed up in the situation she got mixed up in.
Yeah.
A little surprising.
And she's going to, again, pursue her Juris Doctor now while incarcerated. Another thing, let me look here. Hold on, I'm trying to find it. Apparently the program she's going through, the Minnesota Department of Corrections, that's the department that takes custody of you when you go to prison. You're committed to the Commissioner of Corrections for however duration of time. That's how that's worded, right? They have a variety of programs. Now, as a defense attorney, I normally don't get too deep into advising my clients who are going to prison on the Department of Correction programs, and the reason for that is the judges here in town, a district court judge in Minnesota, can't tell the Department of Corrections what to do or not to do with somebody who's in prison. They don't have any control over that person at that point. But there are a variety of programs in the Department of Corrections. People are getting treatment, mental health, help in theory, okay? But a judge who's sending somebody to prison can't order the Commissioner of Corrections to give this person treatment or put them in this program. It doesn't work like that, right? It's up to the Commissioner of Corrections. They're, the gatekeeper of their programs. And there's a variety. Challenge incarceration is one that many of my clients ask about. It's, in essence, boot camp is the short of it. That's what they call it. Inmates call it boot camp. We're talking nonviolent offenders, okay? People who aren't convicted of serious assaults, that type of thing. They can apply for boot camp. And really, it's a way to get out of prison sooner. There's some admission requirements. You need to have so much of your prison term remaining. But once you get in, it's kind of a fast track to ending your time with the commissioner of corrections. Not available to everyone, but just an example of a program. Back to Marine, apparently there's a Department of Corrections program called Prison to Law Pipeline. She's going to school. I'm just looking at what was sent to me. Going to school through the Prison to Law Pipeline. It's not clear to me if that's the Department of Corrections program. I mean, it must be. Certainly they're ordaining or authorizing it, right? But apparently there's a program, Prison to Law Pipeline. And there are probably other educational opportunities for incarcerated people. That, I don't think, is a unique idea either, right? I mean, people have earned all sorts of degrees, I think, while incarcerated. What makes her story particularly unique is the nature of the degree in which she's earning. She's been accepted into a law school and is earning a Juris Doctor. But at any rate, and the whole point of my long-winded spiel here is that she's going to school through what's called the Prison to Law Pipeline. Another note that her friend has shared, or at least reminded me of, the gentleman who actually committed this homicide. Again, we don't need to rehash all the facts of her case. We could spend a whole podcast doing it.
Well, we and
you know,
we did.
So we did. You go listen to it. Yeah, go listen to that, right?
Podcast and find out that information. Yeah.
He was not sentenced to life in prison.
Now, didn't he eventually later confess, yeah, it was all me?
Yeah.
Okay, let her go, or essentially.
He signed an affidavit, you know, basically describing, yeah, you know, she didn't know what I was about to do,
okay,
et cetera. But
didn't change
of
anything.
Of this whole scenario, she's the only one who got sentenced to life.
So is this one of the reasons? Because I know that sometimes, you know, in, for example, this was starting to happen with the other police officers that were involved in the George Floyd case, that they wanted to try them all at the same time. Maybe this is one of the reasons that you try individuals at the same time so they get equal treatment, or at least you can get a balance based on what the jury decides.
I mean, when you are trying people, and so there is a whole, you know, if you look at the rules of criminal procedure, it sets forth the requirements for it. I've opposed these motions to join defendants. That's not, you know, one of the considerations, but it certainly could be a practical consideration of it. You know, that's kind of one of the bigger complaints of criminal justice as a general matter, is how, you know, uneven outcomes can be.
Well,
right? How terribly uneven they can be. I could commit a crime here in Duluth, Minnesota, and my punishment is kind of driven by, I don't know, just kind of the whole progressive climate of our criminal justice system, as how we specifically here in the Northland view, you know, some of these things as reflected by who we have on the bench, et cetera, what, right?
Well,
but then someone in Marshall, Minnesota could have an entirely different outcome.
And that was what I was leading up to, is that, you know, when it really comes down to it, these decisions are they're subjective.
Right.
You know, whether it's the judge or the jury, these are subjective decisions. They're not objective totally. I mean, I think that you can make some objective observations and that sort of thing. But in the end, if you're not giving equal justice to equal crimes, then obviously it's subjective, right?
Right. I'm guessing the difference here, and I don't want to misstate something, but I'm suspecting what happened here is he probably, though I'd have to look, resolved his case with a murder in the second degree, which isn't a life sentence. She went to trial, was ultimately indicted on murder in the first degree, which is a life sentence if convicted of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it really could be a different of how procedurally these things played out based upon willingnesses to resolve the case in a certain fashion, et cetera.
Are all life sentences, is the condition without but parole, or are there exceptions to that?
I'd have to double check. I don't know offhand.
I seem to remember reading something just recently that someone had received a life sentence with possibility of parole after 30 years.
In my practice, I have never had a client yet indicted on murder in the first degree. So I've never had to answer the question.
Is that the only crime that you are given
a
life sentence for?
Correct.
Murder in the first degree?
You know, the liability can be really high. And other cases that don't involve murder, we had a case in Duluth, a number of years ago, this gentleman was convicted after trial of some pretty heinous criminal sexual conduct charges related to a special needs daughter. Mm-hmm. Do you remember this case a number of years ago?
Sounds familiar, but
I don't.
I don't remember the details.
I can't remember. I mean, I think it was a couple first degrees he was convicted of. He had already had, and the court found, a basis for an upward departure. This was a local judge. I think Judge Forkey sentenced him, to two 30-year sentences on each count consecutive, so 60 years, virtually a life sentence. I think the Court of Appeals ultimately said, actually, that was too much of a sentence, and I can't remember the legal reasoning why. Let him go down to 57 years, as if that matters. But anyways, get a little off track here. So, murder in the first degree, life sentence. We've talked about the guideline system in Minnesota, and I've really come to appreciate it. I do more and more stuff in Wisconsin now. They don't have a guideline system there. Hmm. You know, Minnesota, we have this, there's three different grids, a standard grid, a sex offender grid, basically, and a drug grid. We're talking felony offenses. And it's as easy as calculating someone's criminal history score, which is usually easy. You're just looking at past prior felony convictions within a certain duration of time. Certain misdemeanors count if you have enough of them, and you come up with a point total. You look on the grid, you look at the severity of the offense, and it tells you a range that the court is legally bound to follow, unless they depart, which requires a certain legal standard. But the bottom line is it creates some pretty good uniformity, and that's the whole idea of it, right? Wisconsin, they don't have that. It's a statutory max. We have these classes of felonies, class A being the worst, all the way to, I or something.
So it's inevitably up to the judge. Just...
And the judge even sets the parole time.
Okay.
You know, Minnesota, it's you do 2/3 of your sentence, and the last third you don't do, that's your period of parole.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, so for better or worse, like you said, it's set up, it's there, and we use it.
Right. So, anyways, a little off topic, but those are the updates I have in terms of Marine's case, Sarah.
So this was clearly not an individual based on the information that you received. It's not an individual that was caught up in a system and she turned to the only resources she had, which was on the street or whatever. This is someone who was brought up in it sounds like a fairly affluent family.
Made some bad choices.
And just got involved with the wrong individual.
Right.
Right.
Has there been any word that if she completes her program at Hamline, then what happens next? Because that was the question when we talked initially. You know, can she actually become an attorney? Well,
he meant to
not behind bars. Can she take the bar?
I saw an article and I meant to read it and bring it in and talk about that very question. Maybe we'll have to continue that too.
Okay.
But it was an article I found. I think that was generally commenting on the ethics of it.
Right.
And I meant to go back to it, but you reminded me now. I'll have to find that.
And has the administration at Hamline said anything as far as we know? This is why, and this is what we think, and...
No.
That you've seen? Okay,
Hold on a second. I feel...
Because they're like we pointed out, they're taking some criticism for this as well, because, as you mentioned, some people are questioning the ethics of it.
Let me look real quick. Give me a minute.
Okay.
And the ethics, and just so, we can rehash that, because Kevin and I were talking about this before, that the ethics of it is, can you have an officer of the court, a felon officer of the court, performing legal duties?
You can't. You can't vote. You can't do a whole lot of things.
Right.
So can you be a practicing attorney? Probably not.
Understand the ethics of it, right?
Yeah.
I'm just, I noticed an email that had come through. I get the alumni emails from Mitchell.
Okay.
And so here's one from this month. And it doesn't really give us any additional information. The headline just reads, Mitchell Hamline School of Law, an all-square partner in prison-to-law pipeline program. And then it has just a little blurb about Marine. Doesn't really give us any information. I think that's beyond what we've already discussed. But
okay.
Well, that in itself is the school is going to be open about, accepting her into the program. So, that in itself is an indication that, obviously just by accepting her is an indication that they're positive about it. right?
Yeah.
But I guess if she graduates, if she completes it, what happens next?
That's a great question.
I have a feeling she's going to do it.
This is some information I missed from Mitchell. Apparently, they emailed it to me once. The prison-to-law pipeline is an extension of an existing partnership between Mitchell Hamlin and All Square. I have to look to see what All Square is.
Okay.
Which have collaborated to provide civil legal services to those returning home from prison since 2018.
Okay. Well, we'll just keep an eye on it. Yeah, I mean, it's not only fascinating, it's relatively local. So
full support of the Department of Corrections.
I think that, you know, the information that you received and it's been the most surprising is the fact that she had two undergraduate degrees already, and obviously her high school diploma and two undergraduate degrees.
Doctors and lawyers in the family.
Before she got into this predicament.
Right.
And so it's somebody who clearly was educated and was pursuing education on a regular basis.
And people of all education levels make stupid decisions, as we know.
Sure, yeah.
It's still kind of surprising, though.
Yeah.
So, moving on to the next topic, if you guys are ready. And I don't know how, you know, this is obviously a really decisive thing. We spoke on the podcast, I think a couple podcasts ago, and this was before we had an actual decision. We talked about the potential of Roe versus Wade being overturned. At that point, I think we were still operating with a leaked opinion, but, you know, still the uncertainty as to whether or not that's going to be the opinion that sticks, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose it maybe makes some sense to revisit that now that we have an opinion. Obviously, a terribly decisive topic.
Divisive, you mean?
Divisive topic. We don't need to dive too deep into that, but it's worth, you know, we could objectively look at it and try to get some thoughts and opinions.
Well, one of the, you know, and I recall from the last podcast, one of the things that you had mentioned that you found remarkable about the potential decision, now a final opinion, is that generally speaking, opinions that have already been litigated, that have already been discussed and decided, don't generally get overturned by, you know, decisions that were made by former Supreme Court justices don't ordinarily get overturned by future Supreme Court justices. They respect decisions that have been made in the past. It's been done, and they move on to other topics. But so that's what you found interesting about it.
And so, yeah, I mean, stare decisis, and we talked about that, and the legal, the standard, and, you know, it more or less hinged on how terribly wrong you felt the prior decision was, right? I mean, a little more maybe specific and nuanced than that. But now we have a decision in which they have, you know, overruled not just one precedent, but multiple. And that's what people oftentimes forget. Roe versus Wade was just the first, right? Mm-hmm. But that wasn't actually really the operating law, so to speak. In the 90s, there was Casey versus Planned Parenthood. You know, Roe versus Wade, you know, created this trimester format for determining when the government has a sufficient interest in a fetus such that they can stop a woman from getting an abortion. And that they said, well, first trimester you don't, second and third you can ban an abortion in that regard, right? Casey versus Planned Parenthood, I think, more or less better refine that timeline, and is talking about viability, right? So it kind of, you know, I guess changed the view on when the government can interfere. Dobbs versus, what is it, Jackson's? I forget the court caption here in Mississippi. Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. I think what at issue there was a 15-week window in which you could get an abortion. I think that was the nature of the Mississippi law that was being challenged, that after 15 weeks, you can't. And I think where, you know, John Roberts, I get the sense at least his push here was to not go as far as what the court did, and that they just basically determined, no, the U.S. Constitution does not protect any right to an abortion. That's a decision entirely up to the people through their elected representatives and state governments. I think Roberts' approach, and maybe he would think I'm misstating this, is that we should really just be looking at the Mississippi law in 15 weeks, and I can find that that is fine from a you know, constitutional perspective, but not go so far as to say, you know, it just doesn't exist at all as a right under the federal constitution. Alito's decision, I think more or less is what was in the leaked opinion, in that this isn't something that's listed explicitly as a right in the Constitution. It's not. You don't find the word abortion there, right? I think opponents or people arguing the contrary position are going to point out the 14th Amendment and this concept of liberty and that, you know, what is liberty? What are protected liberties? What aren't, right? That's when you probably start talking about a right to privacy that also isn't explicitly listed in the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Alito says, well, what we have to look at in determining whether or not something's a protected liberty is whether or not it's deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition. That's it. And if you're proposing something as a liberty such that it's worthy of constitutional protection, it's got to be deeply rooted in our history and tradition. And if it's not, then the usage of the word liberty in the 14th Amendment doesn't contemplate that. Does that make sense?
Well, I suppose.
But what's the timeline cut off?
So that's the reasoning. And because abortion has never, according to him, been deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition.
Well, it just seems like it's sort of an ambiguous.
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing. The whole thing.
Deeply rooted, you know, we're a nation that is 50 years old now?
Yeah.
It's one of these standards, and I was having this, my brother's in town, and we were trying to think deeply about this. I mean, my conclusion is you can word your opinion on what is rooted in our nation's history and traditions. You can word that in such a way to get to the conclusion you want.
Yeah.
I could say, and I could convince you that medical decisions are personal, and that notion is deeply rooted in our history and tradition, and nobody would disagree, right?
Right.
And then when I want to use the same logic and say that, you know, an abortion falls under that umbrella, provided it's within a certain timeline after you've had sex, but then all of a sudden people say, oh, that's not medical, you know. But my point is you can kind of try to carve this and arrive at whatever conclusion you want to do it.
It's such a vague reference. It's almost like a timeline reference. So, I mean, you know, you could equally go back and say, well, it is deeply rooted. In fact, it's been the law of the land for the last 50 years.
Well, that's what
but
I mean.
Is that deep enough?
And what's deeply rooted? You know, are we going back to our forefathers?
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that, you know, Judge Thomas has indicated that we're not going to stop here.
Right.
That he indicated, you know, there are a number of things that need to be corrected with regards to, you know.
I mean, he specifically called out this case in Texas, Lawrence, I forget the full caption. It's frequently read in law school. Two men, and I don't know factually how this even happened, get caught, you know, having sex. Okay. And sodomy illegal in Texas at that time. They get criminally prosecuted for this. It goes all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay? And now just using Alito's rationale.
Deeply rooted.
Is your right
Stop
to have...
Stop it now.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Well.
Is your right to have gay sex deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition?
I see, and I would say that, you know, according to the 14th Amendment, it is.
I mean... The idea that the government could say, no, we can control what you're doing in the bedroom, how you're going to masturbate, how you're going to have sex.
I mean, whatever you're going to do.
That strikes me as offensive, right? Yeah. I mean, like.
Yeah.
Concerning at the very least.
But I guess my point is, I mean.
Well, but again, you know, and I think that's why the 14th Amendment keeps coming into it, because that is, you know, you should be allowed to do whatever you want. In within the privacy of your own home, isn't it? Not affecting anybody else. You know,
you can't commit murder in your house. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't do criminal stuff.
Well, again, as long as it's not affecting anybody else's rights. That's what I'm saying.
It's not like we're just kind of bringing this to an extreme logic. Like this is the stuff Clarence Thomas himself is more or less verbally saying should have a target on it. Right?
Yeah.
Man.
And you know, I mean, you can obviously hear the dog whistles here. It isn't like that's an objective thing to say. He's picking and choosing, you know, cherry picking certain things.
Yeah.
That even though he hasn't said he finds it offensive, he finds it offensive to the law of the land.
I mean, think of the effect. You know, it's one thing with, so they've overturned Roe versus Wade. States are, you know, scrambling to enact prohibition. Some had trigger laws that just automatically have gone into effect now that Roe versus Wade is overturned. But the impact on people, it's almost like it's future impact. It's different than overturning, an example, the case that has protected same-sex marriage. That's another case that has a target on it, right? And you'll find many politicians saying the U.S. Supreme Court was wrong to issue a decision that your right to same-sex marriage is constitutionally protected. But if that's overturned, we're talking about people are married, who are so intertwined already, right? Like, how does that mess get undone? Like, I mean...
Well, starting today...
Think about how severe the impact of that decision is, right? You have people who have... And I'm kind of getting off track here, but who have a same-sex marriage. Maybe they've even adopted a child.
Sure.
Maybe they've even since divorced.
Sure.
And they have a custody order, you know? Yeah. And now, I mean, how is any of this going to work out?
Like, you know, that's a great question, but I still continue to go back to what is law.
Yeah.
And you know, in the past, even though, you know, we can call these people conservative justices or liberal justices, they have found a way to maintain a high degree, I think, of objectivity. I mean, it's not necessarily, it has never been all cut and dry. And especially Roe v. Wade is a good example of that.
Yeah.
Because how many times has it been challenged, and how many times have they ended up saying, no, this is, this has already been decided.
Right.
But now we're with a Supreme Court that evidently is willing to take on subjects before they're even presented to them.
Yeah,
you know that they're issuing. They're saying, you know what? I'm not sure that this is okay either. But it hasn't even been brought to them. You know, so that to me is what I find troubling.
Yeah,
you know, with the comments made by Clarence Thomas that he's bringing up gay marriage or whatever in a certain case that involves that before it's even presented to him. Before it's even presented to the court. So that, to me, sounds like what a lot of people, and I don't like to use this word too much with regard to the court, but that does kind of sound rogue.
So this kind of comes maybe to some and leads to my final point of discussion here. And that's what's to be done about it. And I don't know. I don't know the answers. Maybe nothing. We just keep the status quo of our system in which we have 9 justices. President appoints, Senate confirms. That's what we have. Everyone's heard the term court packing, and I think has a good understanding of what that in essence means.
A little easier said than done.
Led me to look at the history of the court here, which I thought was kind of fascinating, because I'm not sure everybody knows we haven't always had 9 justices. In fact, if you look at the Constitution, it doesn't tell us in there how many justices are required to be on the Supreme Court. It doesn't say. It doesn't say.
We just like 9.
And we haven't always liked 9. 9 we've had since 1869.
We didn't for a while. We only had 8 for a while, right? So just not that long ago.
A law under John Adams required, as few as 5. Under Abraham Lincoln, apparently there was... as many as there are 10, like that number for the first half, or maybe less than half at this point, but for decades after the formation of our country, was a moving target. It changed. And it's only been consistent since 1869. Well, I say only, that's obviously a very long time, but there was many, many years where it was kind of moving at political whims. And that's just what would happen. The last time I think there was any meaningful effort to change the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court was during FDR's presidency.
Hmm.
He had attempted, at least, and I think, and it's all the same, you know, back when this was happening during the Civil War, and even when FDR was doing it, it's because they were just disgruntled with the status of the court and the decisions that were coming out of it. I mean, that's how, let's be honest, if ever there's a change, that's that's why there's a change,
someone's
right?
Someone's unhappy.
Somebody's unhappy with it. But he was proposing as many as 15, and that even went to Senate vote. So this is under a proposed legislation during FDR. All sitting justices older than 70 apparently would have been asked to resign. If any refused, FDR would be able to nominate an additional justice to the bench. At the time, 6 of the 9 justices were over 70, which created the possibility of adding 6 new seats as a result. Ultimately failed by Senate vote of 70 to 20. You know, but this idea that the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court changed, it's not novel or new. You know, it hasn't been discussed, I think, with any real sincerity in quite some time, but it is a concept that is kind of, I don't know.
I'm sort of, I'm personally, you know, and I'll just give you my personal opinion, I'm uncomfortable with expanding this
court. I mean, me too. Like, I'm
because it's been the way we have used it, and expanding the court, to me, is an obvious political maneuver.
What about,
you know,
what about term limits?
I'm okay with that. I've never quite understood why they have to be lifetime nominated. I'm all right with term limits, but expanding the number of justices on the court, I'm uncomfortable with.
But that would seem like term limits seems like they'd be a good middle ground between the two.
It just seems like a logical thing to do.
Like, I feel like you can do a term limit while still recognizing that you don't want to overly, you know, if it was like a 4-year term limit, okay, that's a nightmare. Right.
Imagine, that's a mess every 4 years. Well, yeah, with every presidential election, there's
99% of their time bickering about this topic.
Yep.
But if it was like
12 20, years,
20 even?
A 14-year term. I don't know. 20-year. Yeah, that's what I'm, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you have justices who
can sit there as long as they
30
want.
30 to 40 years on the bench.
Yeah.
Ginsburg was, what, 87?
And even her biggest proponents tend to be a little critical of her for sticking around too long and...
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I mean, I'm sure that they're actually just even based on all of them listening to this podcast, they're considering it right now.
Well,
yeah, right.
That was sarcastic.
We never know who's listening, as we've recently
found out.
You never
do know. You never know. But again, I'm uncomfortable with expanding the court, which would, again, be an obvious political maneuver.
I think a term limit would be easier to sell, because if, especially if it's a lengthy term limit, nobody, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, Independent, nobody can reasonably anticipate what's going to, who's president 20 years from now,
right?
You know, like.
And I'm sorry, you're a big proponent of this particular judge, but 20 years is 20 years. We all agreed to it.
Yeah.
Of course, you would expect that, you know, the only way that they could change it to term limits are to be voted by people that don't have them themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
With the exception of the president, who would have to sign it.
Yeah. Term limits.
Hmm. All right. Well, anything else we want to hit on this particular venture into train wreck court?
I think we covered a variety of things. It sounds good.
All right.
Yeah, good discussion.
All right.
Yeah, always is. Always is. Train Wreck Court available wherever you get your podcast. Of course, you can catch Andrew weekly on the afternoon Train Wreck. Andrew, if people want to contact you, what can they do?
You should check out my website. What is it again? Northlandlawyers.com.
Northlandlawyers.com. You're not watching enough TV.
You'll see
commercials on a lot.
Olson, Poole, and Enval, we can help you with any personal injury, workers' compensation, Social Security, family law need. I, of course, practice in all areas of criminal defense, but Northlandlawyers.com.
That is Trainwreck Court. Till next time, everyone.
Thanks, guys.